Okay, well, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speaker. We are very fortunate at Marxism 2011 to have a range of international speakers. Our speaker for this session is Lars Lee. He's an independent scholar based in Montreal. He's written, and many of you will have read this, I think, before the session, I think a wonderful and comprehensive book, rescuing much of what is to be done from many of those who claim to know all about it. He's also got a new, slightly smaller book, biography of Lenin, and copies of the biography of Lenin are also on their way to this room, haven't quite reached here yet. And just to whet your appetite for the future, he's also going to be embarking on a new project, looking at Bukharin. So, but today he'll be talking about echoes of what is to be done in Lenin's later years. As with all the sessions, we'll be leaving the questions and discussion part until after the speaker has finished. But of course, people should think if you have questions that occur to you during the course of the introduction, please note them down and we'll have a whole period of discussion and so on after Lars has finished. So without further ado, I will hand over to Lars Lee.
So I found that when I sometimes when I meet people, they say, "Oh yeah, you're the Lars Lee who showed in your book that Lenin's sense of the party was similar to the German social democracy," and that's true. I am that Lenin. I am that Lee. There's another side of what I wanted to do in the book, the big book, and the small book. That side, the one I just mentioned, is the side that stresses, Lenin in context, Lenin's links with the other people. But there is also a theme of Lenin's individuality and distinctiveness, which I locate, for me, which strikes me, is optimism, what I call in my new book, A Heroic Scenario, an optimism, a revolutionary, romantic almost, or more than almost, a view of what's going on. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I find when you read Lenin that there's this strange combination of sort of polemics, which can be very, focused and narrow and angry and sometimes rather hard to relate to, especially if you read tons of it. But also hidden away. So that's the theme of the article or the speech or whatever it is. But there's a side of the other side is the sort of passionate side, which I find often in the last paragraph when he's summing up or somewhere. That it's that passionate side that I wanted to bring out and to systematize and to take out. So that's what I'm going to be doing, and so I'm going to be reading Lenin quotations because that's what I want to bring out. So we'll talk about what is to be done, and I call this the echoes of what is to be done because that book was not. It's not direct discussions of it or direct reactions to it or continuations, mostly. Because, What Is to Be Done was written in 1902. That was at a time when on the one hand, there was the existence of the party was completely illegal. It was trade unions, so they had to be underground completely. But also at a time when there was a name, the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, but there wasn't any national institutions. There were local organizations. They existed in the various cities around this Russian Empire, but there was no national organization. So what is to be done with this? That was what it's written in for that situation as a strategy, as a plan to get from that situation to a situation where you had national institutions. You had a central committee. It didn't exist in 1902. You had an official newspaper. Lenin was associated with the newspaper Iskra at the time, but it was not an official. It was self-appointed. You had party congresses, national institutions. So, that's what he wanted to do, and that's what his book is about. Well, in a sense, What Is to Be Done became irrelevant because of its own success or the success of the project which it was involved in, because there was the national institutions. They got the party. The party split then, of course, you all know Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, but on issues that weren't taken up particularly in what has been done. So what has been done? Slipped back into sort of being a book into another period of history, especially after the 1905 revolution when other issues became extremely important. So about the only time Lenin refers to what has been done several times, often in 1905 during the revolution, as I'll explain. And then in 1907, he had an anthology of his works up to that time. It's called something like 10 years or something like this. And it's included there, and he discusses it in the preface. But after that, nothing. And if you trace the history of the book, it was not the idea that it was sort of a founding document of Bolshevism isn't correct, because it's just, well, as I say, it was not particularly considered relevant. And it was only really after Lenin's death, and some years after Lenin's death, where it sort of began to rise to its present-day prominence. It's sort of retrospective. The actual argument, the actual proposals, the actual sort of concrete side of what has to be done is then sort of became in the back. But the world outlook, the political outlook of what is to be done, that's what I think is still relevant. And in any event, it still shows Lenin's individuality, and it shows that's why I want to find the. So what I find is that the basic themes that I see in what is to be done do occur later. I sort of discovered it because I was doing this book. And I was going through the whole and the whole writings and found many times where the same themes in the same language. So that helped me understand what has to be done a little bit better, because I could see what was most important to Lenin in that book. And also what has to be done helps you understand what's going on. So that's why I say echoes, because there are certain themes, which I'll try to get down, that come up again. Okay, so what are the themes? What I see is that Lenin, the basis of his outlook was what I call a scenario. Why do I use that word? Because it's sort of it's an underlying interaction, a dynamic interaction between leaders of various kinds and followers. And when I say, I sort of say the key theme is inspiring leadership. And by this, I certainly don't mean a great leader inspiring the masses. When Lenin talks about leadership, of course, he isn't talking about that. But rather, there are thousands of more ordinary but still effective leaders who, in Lenin's vision, arise out of the masses themselves. Think of a worker pushing himself forward at a street demonstration and arguing, urging the crowd to take revolutionary actions. That is sort of the little drama that he has in mind and wants to see happen. But heroic, inspiring leaders require heroic followers. That is to say, if you go out and give a speech, then it's half of what happens next is, well, more than half of what happens next is what the people are listening to you do with it. Lenin says to would-be activist leaders, the workers are ready to hear and to heed your message. And because of this, says Lenin, a single activist, a single praktik can accomplish miracles. And I'm quoting him. I'm not just paraphrasing. So what I'm going to do in the talk then is to talk about three aspects of this interaction. And what I'll do in each case is look at what is to be done, and then I'll look at later stuff. So I'll kind of go back and forth. I'm sorry about that, but I think it brings out what I want to bring out. The three themes are the workers as followers, as eager, ready to be inspired, as it were, followers, then this workers as potential leaders, and then finally, third theme, the miracles that result when those two meet. Okay, followers. Lenin and his friends, the people in the Iskra, a newspaper, set themselves a very remarkable mission in and around the turn of the century. They were a tiny band of émigrés living in Switzerland and London and so forth. They were going to print an underground newspaper, smuggle it into the vast Russian Empire, had to be smuggled, of course, and they hoped that their newspaper would spark off the overthrow of the Tsar. That was the aim. And that's why they call the newspaper the Spark, or Iskra. And what a newspaper. And I have here, if you ever get a chance to look at a facsimile of Iskra, I don't know if you won't be able to really see it, except for the people in the front row, but I have a picture here of Iskra. Can you see? It's very dense print. It's, you know, and I've seen, you know, it's so it wouldn't win any journalism, I don't think, layout awards today. It's hard going, and I take it from me, it's hard to read. It's not dumbed down propaganda for the masses, but it's in fact suitable only for really people who are quite serious and industrious readers. And yet, we are told by many scholars that Lenin was pessimistic about the revolutionary inclinations of the workers. And it's against that interpretation, of course, that I've written, what I've written against. One influential founder, a person who writes about this, Adam Ulam, noticed this problem and said what has been done was, quote, a remarkably illogical performance. And why? Because if Lenin had such a low view of the workers, how did he expect his feeble little underground newspaper, his persecuted, shaky little underground organization, and Lenin himself stressed how shaky and little it was, to stir the masses into action. So Ulam sort of noticed that there was a problem in his interpretation, but he decided that it was Lenin's problem, not his problem. Okay, that's 10 minutes I've done, or 10 minutes, okay, good. But what is to be done is not remarkably illogical. In fact, it's logical enough once you grasp what is really Lenin's basic premise, namely that the workers as a whole are ready, eager, and willing to receive the revolutionary message. For example, Lenin asks himself, why don't the Russian workers in 1902, or when he was writing most of it, protest more than they are against all the abuses created by the Tsarist system? For example, the police's bestial treatment of the people, the persecution of sectarians, the religious minorities, the corporal punishment of peasants, the outrages of the censor, the torment of the soldiers, the persecution of the most harmless cultural undertakings, and so forth. Notice it's not worker issues, general issues. Is this lack of protest, Lenin asked the reader, because the worker feels it's not his business or because the worker is only interested in his own economic struggle? No, it's because we social democrats, we revolutionaries, we undergrounders, have not done enough to tell the worker about all the abuses. And all we have to do is really throw exposés and journalistic indictment to the worker masses. Now I'm quoting Lenin. If we do this, and we must do it, and we can do it, the very simplest worker will understand or will feel that the dark force that mocks and oppresses the student and the sectarian, the mujik and the writer, is the same that oppresses and weighs on him at each step of his life. And when he does feel this, he will himself desire with an overwhelming desire to respond, and he will know how to do it. So that's the kind of passionate prose that I just like stylistically, you know, that's when Lenin, when he's really, on, which comes and goes, that's unfortunately. okay. Lenin's attitude toward the workers can be seen as reacting to a man named Sergei Zubatov. Zubatov was a Tsarist police official who started unions. They're called the Zubatov unions. And, remember that unions of any kind were illegal, but what Zubatov's idea was that the police would set up semi-legal unions so that the workers could pursue their economic struggle. He was one of the more enlightened people who realized that the workers had to have a political struggle, economic struggle, while remaining loyal, even grateful to the Tsar for allowing them to do this. What was Lenin's, it lasted for 2 or 3 years, this experiment. What was Lenin's reaction to this so-called police socialism? Well, if we thought that Lenin was worried about the workers being reformist, obviously he would say, "Oh my God, they're going to reform. They're going to steal our thunder. We're in trouble." No, in fact, Lenin's attitude was very brash. The opposite of that. Instead, indeed, it could be summed up as, "Bring it on." According to Lenin, these police unions were good for the revolutionary underground in every way. The police took over the job of providing legal worker literature so that the underground didn't have to worry about that. They could concentrate on smuggling in the stronger stuff. For another thing, there was no chance the workers would be taken in by any length of time by the anti-democratic, anti-revolutionary measures of Zubatov. That's what Lenin said in What Is to Be Done in 1902. A year or so later, a revolution in 1905 started off in a way that reminded Lenin of the predictions he had made in this earlier book. In 1905, a follower of Zubatov, Father Gapon, G-A-P-O-N, led the workers to present a loyal, peaceful petition to the Tsar, asking just for you know, reforms, and they were shot down, I mean literally shot down, by the government on Bloody Sunday, January 1905, leading to a radicalization of large sectors of the working class and a revolution. Okay, one reason I want to emphasize this is that there are prominent writings on the prominent writers on the left, and I mean Tony Clift's book on Lenin in this case, who want to compliment Lenin by saying, look how he changed his mind in 1905 when he saw the workers in rebellion. But that's not accurate. He did not change his mind. He did not have to change his mind. He, in fact, what he did say was, he said, see, the outbreak of the revolution proves just how right I was and what is to be done. And he quotes what is to be done. He quotes the stuff that about Zubata, for example. He quotes what he said, what is to be done. Even the most backward workers would be drawn into the revolutionary movement by the Zubata people. The prediction he felt was borne out by the events of the 1905 revolution. So I could go into it, but I think this is important because prominent people on the left will say that Lenin changed his mind in 1905, and I just think that's meant to be a compliment, but it's not, because it misinterprets what is to be done. Toward the end of his political career, Lenin did become less confident about the ability of the worker masses to resist the blandishments of the bourgeoisie. In 1921, a Bolshevik party member asked him to propose a free press, and Lenin said, no, we can't have a free press. Free press means we allow the bourgeois to publish newspapers, and that would be equivalent to political suicide, and we're not ready to commit suicide. So in 1921, for lots of reasons which we'd go into, he wasn't as confident. But he still had his idea that the masses were thirsting for knowledge and enlightenment. That was a very deep sense of his thing. Thank you. This deep faith and just feeling about what the Russian workers and masses in general were like found itself in the way he argued for practical proposals. So what I'm more interested in is not the practical proposals themselves, which come and go, but how he argued for them, the kind of style he argued for them. He insisted in What Is To Be Done that Russian workers were desperately eager for knowledge, for reading, for enlightenment, for information about the world. He said over and over again in his book that any activists who restricted their agitation to immediately local, strictly economic disputes were not doing the workers any favor, since the workers themselves had wider horizons. In one of his published articles in 1923, we're familiar with some of his most famous, you know, his final writings, but this one is overlooked, I think. It's called Pages from a Diary. Lenin returned to the theme in a plea to make education and literacy campaigns a top priority. And I sort of use this particular statement, I sort of use it as almost a climactic final thing here in the book. Okay, so now it's Lenin, 1923. We're speaking of this weeks before his final stroke. We are speaking of the semi-Asiatic absence of culture from which we have not yet extricated ourselves, we the Russians, and from which we cannot extricate ourselves without a strenuous effort. Although certainly the possibility exists of our doing so, because nowhere else in the world are the masses of the Narod. The Narod is the Russian word for the people, you know, Narodniks and so forth. Masses of the people so interested in real culture as they are in our country. Nowhere are the problems of culture posed so profoundly and consistently as they are in our country. In no other country is the state power in the hands of the working class, which in its mass is fully aware of its own deficiencies. I shall not say of its culture, but of its literacy. Nowhere else is the working class so ready to make, and nowhere is it actually making such sacrifice to improve its position in this respect in our country. So there is an echo, as I say, throughout his life of that particular theme, that sort of as we're great workers, great leaders require great followers, and at least the Russian working class are those. Okay, now I'm going on to the second theme, which is workers as leaders. Lenin is, of course, associated with the idea that only intellectuals can be good leaders or, quote-unquote, professional revolutionaries. In actuality, a central feature of Lenin's image of the ideal revolutionary activist is worker origins. This is the ideal. He realizes that in real life it depends. Lenin is very eloquent on this theme and What Is To Be Done. He says that workers are constantly pushing forward. That's the word, push forward, we do be guts. Leaders from their own ranks, and therefore the revolutionary social democrats should do much more than they are doing to help this process along. Why? Because, Lenin told his readers, genuine party leaders from worker ranks are the best kind, and if we had more of them, we'd be unbeatable. So he lists all the wonderful qualities that a worker who rises up in the party organization will acquire. I'm now quoting again. The worker acquires, this kind of worker who rises up, acquires experience and dexterity in his trade, or professional, of revolutionary activity. He broadens his horizon and his knowledge. He observes close up the political leaders of the other localities and other parties. He attempts to lift himself to this level and emerge in himself a knowledge of the worker milieu, plus a freshness of socialist conviction, with a kind of full apprenticeship in his trade, professia of revolution, without which the proletariat cannot conduct a stubborn struggle with the excellently trained ranks of its enemies. So three things: knowledge of worker milieu, freshness of socialist conviction, apprenticeship in his sort of professional tasks. So he says, if we had these kind of leaders, he says, no political police in the world will be able to cope with these detachments of worker revolutionaries, because these detachments of people, boundlessly devoted to the revolution, will also be able to rely on the boundless confidence of the broadest worker masses. So you can see kind of a link. That's what I call the inspiring leadership. These people are inspired by themselves, and then they inspire others. In 1905, there was an argument among Bolsheviks about whether to put an effort to put more workers on the committees. Again, Lenin was for doing this, and he wasn't changing his mind, as some writers on the left say. But he himself and others in the debate emphasized that he was being consistent. I'm going to skip over an interesting example that shows Lenin's view of worker leaders, because I have two examples here. One, Roman Malinovsky in 1912 was a police spy, and he looked like the real thing, but he was a fake. I'm interested in the fact that Lenin was the last person to figure this out. And I think the reason is that he was so dedicated to this image. if you're interested, I can go more on that. But I wanted to say something more about a guy named Jakub Sverdlov. People here know that name, Sverdlov? Oh, okay, good. Anyway, he was an old Bolshevik who was taken into the Bolshevik Central Committee about the same time as Malinovsky, around 1912. He was soon arrested, sent to Siberia. In fact, he was probably turned in by Malinovsky. During the first year and a half after the 1970 revolution, he was an important member of the top party leadership, in particular was sort of the organization man. He was the organization man before Stalin was the organization man. He died from illness in early 1919, typhus, I think. If he had lived longer, undoubtedly his name would be even more familiar. In March 1919, Lenin gave a short speech as a eulogy for Sverdlov. You can find it online. It's an extremely revealing one. I wish I had used it in my big book as an example to explain what Lenin meant by leadership. Can you hear me back there? Pardon? Is there a microphone?
No, it's not a mic. It's recording.
Okay. I'll try to speak up. Okay, here we go. Jacob Sverdlov. Lenin treats Sverdlov as an ideal example of the perfect professional revolutionary. Lenin again insists that one quality of an ideal professional revolutionary such as Sverdlov is that he or she comes forth from the people. He uses the same image, even the same word, as in what is to be done, namely pushed forth. In fact, Lenin specifically says that the workers started to replace the older generation of intellectual revolutionaries at the turn of the century. In other words, just at the time when he was writing What Is to Be Done. So he's proud of the fact that we associate, you know, Lenin with intellectuals as leaders. But from Lenin's point of view, just at the time he was writing it, the intellectuals were sort of moving on and the workers were coming in more. And that was very good. He gave a speech in 1919 at the height of the Civil War. And so he notes at the beginning of his remarks, for many observers at the time, the essential quality of the Bolsheviks was their lack of qualms about replying revolutionary violence. But, says Lenin, although the ability to apply violence when needed was a useful quality, it was not the real essence of Bolshevism, since violence is only justified under certain specific conditions. The real essence, says Lenin, is Bolshevism's ability to organize large masses. And by organization, he doesn't mean an efficient office routine. He means essentially being an inspiring leader. So, when you read this eulogy, so he's describing Sverdlov, but he's describing him as the ideal leader. So my idea is that this description of Sverdlov is his idea of the ideal leader. And so what do we get? The ideal leader comes forth from the people, earns love and respect from the workers due to his complete devotion to the cause, always maintains links with the advanced workers despite underground conditions, works hard to instill in himself the necessary practical knowledge and flair. Remember, that was the sort of learn your trade bit theme. And finally, helps make the basic idea of Soviet power an inspiring force throughout the world. That is, there's a global dimension to the inspiring leader. And as a matter of fact, when you read all this stuff about Lenin's view of the leader, you begin to notice that in some ways, he emphasizes how much the inspiring leader can do for the proletarian cause, but it's almost sometimes you feel like he's emphasizing how much the proletarian cause can do for the leaders. And what I mean by that is, the revolutionary workers are a means to a self-realization of the workers because they respond to them. And I have a feeling I myself put a biographical interpretation on this. As you probably know, his brother, was, in the 1880s, was associated with a plot to kill the Tsar. It was an attempt to do what Lenin was trying to do in 1905, to get past the Tsar to a liberal republic, essentially. But Lenin's brother there was no mass movement at the time, so he tried to blow up the Tsar, didn't work, he was hung. So for Lenin, his brother had thrown his life away. And there are two citations. Okay, I'm coming down to the end here. Two citations I'd like to, that bring out this idea that, that in the old days, the leaders of the Russian were throwing away their lives. Now we have a mass movement. Now, we can show our, do it. Here's the quote from What Is to Be Done. It is precisely at the present time, 1902, that the Russian revolutionary, guided by a genuinely revolutionary theory and relying on the class that is genuinely revolutionary and is undergoing an elemental, or that's the word usually translated as spontaneous, awakening, can at last, draw himself up to his full stature and reveal all his heroic strength. And Lenin's word for heroic is bogatyr, which is, from Russian folklore. That's the giant, marvelous heroes of the Russian folk epics. And he could have chosen no better word to evoke what I have to see as a romantic conception of the romantic revolutionary, the Russian revolutionary as a leader. From the Sverdlov, he says this: the history of the Russian revolutionary movement over the course of many decades has known a long list of people devoted to the revolutionary cause, but who did not enjoy the possibility of finding a practical application of their revolutionary ideals. And when I read that, I realize that he's talking about his brother, Alexander. But by the way, Lenin never referred to Alexander by name in public, never. But what I found when I was going through this, it hit me actually going through this when I was revising the draft, that very often this kind of comment is, you can find all along his career. He doesn't say my brother Alexander. He says the long list of people devoted to the revolutionary cause who did not enjoy a possibility of finding a practical application. So he's talking about his brother, I think. And in this connection, the proletarian revolution was the first to give these previously isolated individuals, heroes of the revolutionary struggle, a genuine grounding, a genuine base, a genuine framework, a genuine audience, and a genuine proletarian army where these leaders, vojdi, could reveal themselves. So that's part of Lenin's makeup. So to conclude, the third theme was, how these two, when workers and leaders meet, what happens? And in, as I said, what Lenin says, the word he uses is miracle. And he uses this fairly often. Chudas is in Russian. And when you start looking, words like miracle and miraculous are fairly common in Lenin's vocabulary. I've already cited one comment, you know, that a single activist can bring out miracles. I have other ones from What Is to Be Done. The same thinking is behind another phrase in What Is to Be Done that is already famous. which is, give me an organization of revolutionaries and I will turn Russia around. That's my translation. It's usually, I will turn Russia upside down. What does Lenin mean by this phrase? Does he mean that a band of intelligentsia conspirators will somehow wave their hands and destroy Tsarism? Give me an organization of revolutionaries? No. Lenin is saying this, and this is my paraphrase. Lenin in 1902, my paraphrase. Comrades, look around you. Can't you see that the Russian workers are champing at the bit to receive the message of revolution and act on it? Can't you see that the potential for leadership that already exists among the activists, among the praktiki, that's the Russian word for sort of practical activists, the people on the ground. Can't you see that many more leaders would arise out of the workers if we set our minds to encouraging their rise? Given all this potential, what's holding things up? Why is the Tsar still here? Us, comrades, we're the bottleneck. If we could hone our underground skills and bring together what the Tsarist regime wants so desperately to keep apart, worker leaders and worker followers, the message and the audience, then by God we could blow this joint apart. Or worse to that effect. I mean, that's the paraphrase. So when I came here, I found an article by one Sandra Bloodworth, a good quotation which makes my same point. It's from 1905. It's talking about the Lenin revolution, 1905 revolution as, quote, a festival of the oppressed and exploited. At such times, people are capable of performing miracles. That's why it struck me, if judged by the narrow Philistine scale of gradual progress. And by the way, another thing I noted when I went through the whole Lenin thing is the word Philistine and is constant. So that's the other side of his heroic scenario, is the Philistine who does not accept it. Okay, I'm going to skip one from 1912, but it's good because I'm up at the kind of the end here. But so I'm going to end with one final thing here, which is the idea of we must dream. In a stirring passage near the end of What Is to Be Done, Lenin imagines what would happen if a specific nuts and bolts proposal about a party newspaper were to be put into effect. Lenin admits that his particular scheme in itself was a very small one. But if it were actually carried out, Lenin sees it merging into something much larger. He sees leaders from the intelligentsia and leaders pushed forth, that word again, by the workers, who will take their place at the head of a mobilized army and raise up the whole people, the Narod, to settle accounts with the shame and curse of Russia. That's what we must dream about. Sort of the climactic passage of What Is to Be Done toward the end. Now let's fast forward to early 1923 and look at the last article Lenin wrote for publication, Better, Fewer, But Better, it's called. Here again, Lenin has a specific scheme for a specific problem in mind. He wants to improve the Soviet bureaucracy by enlisting workers off the bench to inspect it and suggest ways to improve on it. The scheme, I'm afraid to say, is a rather desperate and implausible one in itself. But still, Lenin ends his article in a way very similar to the What Is to Be Done passage just quoted. First, he sets forth the nuts and bolts of his scheme. Then he ties the scheme itself to vast and heroic perspectives. So what we have? A broad global revolution, including India, China, and the overwhelming majority of the population of the globe. By the way, I do think this particular article, Better, Fewer, the last couple of pages of this article, again, toward the end he opens up, are good what his vision was at the end of his life, the political career. A broad global revolution, including India, China, and the overwhelming, like I said that. At home, the workers retain the leadership of the peasants, as mentioned, worker leadership, thus enabling the Soviet economy to move symbolically from horsepower to hydroelectric power. He ends up again invoking the need to dream, and this is why I think that I'm connecting it to What Is to Be Done. These are the lofty tasks that I dream of for my worker inspection scheme. So, thus, both in What Is to Be Done and in his final articles, Lenin insists that we must dream. This coincidence is more than a rhetorical flourish. It's the way Lenin's mind works. Lenin comes up with a nuts and bolts scheme for improving this or that, ties it directly to vast world-changing perspectives. Why? Because he has such confidence in the almost literally miraculous power of a particular force, the force of inspiring leadership. And I should say, it's not just, I'm very enthusiastic. It's because people are telling the truth, because they have a particular message that is worthy of inspiration. I hope that's clear. Heroic leaders require heroic followers, and Lenin had an exalted idea of both leaders and followers. This exalted view is the heart of What Is to Be Done, and it is the reason that we find so many echoes of his 1902 book throughout his life.